Today's program has been brought to you by the Brooklyn Slate Company, a manufacturer of slate cheese boards, coasters, and other fine items. For more information, visit www.brooklynslate.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
For tuning into the Heritage Radio Network. We are coming to you from the wonderfully cozy studio in the back of Roberta's restaurant in Bushwick, Brooklyn. And you are listening to Good Food, the show where we talk with people who are using food as a vehicle for social good. I'm your host, Daniel Meyer, and I am so pleased to be joined today by Nancy Hunergarth. Nancy is the president of a consulting firm, which bears her own name, that specializes in nutrition and physical activity advocacy and policy. She's also the co-founder and executive director of the New York State Healthy Eating and Physical Activity Alliance. That is a mouthful, which is dedicated to improving policies and practices that promote healthy eating and physical activity. And as if she isn't busy enough, Nancy has also been the New York State Food Day coordinator for the past 3 years, in addition to writing numerous articles for the likes of the Huffington Post, Grist, and Civil Eats. Undoubtedly, there is more, but her intro would take up the entire show, so I will stop there. Nancy, thank you so much for chatting with us today.
Oh, thank you. I'm exhausted just hearing all that.
Okay, so we're done. Great interview. No, I won't let you off that easy. So you do clearly a lot of different things, so we could touch on a number of different topics here, but I'd love to start with the most immediate, one that's coming up on the calendar in less than a month, and that is Food Day. Will you give us a rundown of what Food Day is and how you're involved with it?
Sure. Well, very simply, this is year three of Food Day, and it's a year-round nationwide celebration and movement towards a healthier, more affordable and sustainable food system. And it culminates in a day of action across the entire nation on October 24th. And it was created by the folks at the Center for Science and the Public Interest out of Washington. And it's really, you know, I describe it to people as Earth Day for food. It's really a day that we celebrate our food system, and we look at what it does right, and then we look at where it needs change and action, and we try to get people excited about moving forward for the entire year.
So what does it look like? What does it look like locally? What does it look like nationally? If I were to stumble out of my apartment on Food Day on October 24th, what might I come across in terms of events or activities?
Well, there are going to be events across the entire nation, I think right now on the Food Day map, and if anybody wants to check it, you can go to www.foodday.org. You'll see about 1,000 events nationwide, and in New York City specifically, the biggest marquee event is going to be the Big Apple Crunch, and this is the second year that the Big Apple Crunch has been held, and this year, the folks who are putting it together, who are comprised of Grow NYC, Food Day, mm-hmm. Some wonderful folks through the mayor's office, are trying to get people to simultaneously crunch into an apple at noon on Food Day so that we've set a world record.
Wow.
And yeah, that's pretty cool. And even better, we're trying to get 1 million crunches. And last year, we got about 400,000 crunches. So this year, we're really aiming high, and we think we're going to get there.
Unbelievable. So that's 12 p.m. on October 24th?
Right. And if people want to participate in that, there's a really easy way to do it. They would go to www.bigapplecrunch.org. They can sign up for a crunch. They can join a crunch. You know, they can find a way to get involved. But the big event, the big kickoff, is going to be at Brooklyn Borough Hall Green Market at 12 p.m. So anybody who wants to go down there and be part of that crunch should get down there.
Fantastic. And if you can't make it to Borough Hall, just keep your ears peeled on October 24th. You might hear it. So you said that part of Food Day is sort of celebrating the aspects of our food system that are working, that thing, you know, things that we have in our system set up that are things that might make us proud. So what are those things? We talk a lot on this show, sort of, for better or for worse, about many of the things that are wrong with our food system, but what are we getting right?
Well, one of the things we're really getting right, in my opinion, is school food. I mean, I'm sure you've been following what's been going on in the past, I guess it's been the past 5 years, where there was a movement to get healthier school food, and then on the federal level, legislation was passed, not only that improved the National School Lunch Program meals. Those are the standard hot meals that you pay, you know, anywhere from, you know, $1.75 to $3, depending mm-hmm. on where you go to school. So those standards were raised, and those meals were improved. And then recently, the government wisely decided to improve what is known as competitive foods. So those are the foods that are sold alongside that hot meal, that National School Lunch Program hot meal. And when you go into any school, it used to be you could get a cookie the size of your head, soda, you know, all kinds of junk food. But now there's been a tremendous change, and the rules were published, and there's really going to be much healthier food in schools across the board.
Have those changes trickled down from paper to the actual lunch trays yet? Are school children actually seeing a marked difference in what they're getting to eat? Because I think it was just yesterday I saw some slideshow, maybe it was on the Huffington Post, of, you know, high schoolers sending in little Instagrams or pictures of their school lunch trays, many of which were sort of the same old fried this and fatty that. How long does it take for the process to sort of see itself through?
Well, as far as the actual school meals, so the lunches that the schools get reimbursed for through both federal and state money, mm-hmm. they should have seen changes in that immediately,
yeah.
because schools were required to make those changes in order to get an additional 6 cents per meal. And I saw that slideshow too, and I remember looking at it. I thought this doesn't look like, you know, this year. This looks like, you know, last year.
Yeah.
So I'm sure that, you know, if you go around and look in different schools, it probably varies depending upon who's cooking in the kitchen. But there are requirements that a certain amount of fruits and vegetables have to be on the tray. There's mm-hmm. requirements about whole grains. There's even requirements about the amount of protein and requirements about the beverages. So there should be real changes in any school that's part of the National School Lunch Program, and I suspect those slides were a little bit old.
Okay, that's good to know. So don't pay attention to the gross foods on the Huffington Post website. So speaking of schools, I saw on the Food Day website that part of the Food Day platform includes a nationwide initiative, I think in coordination with Jamie Oliver, to try to get food education back in every public school across the country. What is that campaign looking like now? What are you really striving for, and why?
Well, basically, I think what we're all thinking is we want to see cooking lessons back in school.
Mm-hmm.
Somehow they've fallen out of favor, or there's not enough of a budget. You know, they never used to be given to both girls and boys, and they certainly, you know, should be offered to both. They should be mandatory for both. And I think that's what we're all hoping for, is, you know, bring back cooking lessons in the school, and along with cooking lessons, you learn about reading labels, you learn about ingredients, you learn about shopping, you know, just good, solid cooking understanding. So, you know, kids aren't afraid to, you know, make something for themselves on the weekend. Unfortunately, our families across America have stopped cooking.
Yeah.
And one of the ways that, we think we can get kids to cook again, or get the next generation to cook again, is to bring cooking skills, bring the teaching of cooking skills back into school, and make it fun and make it interesting and make it something that everyone does together. So that's really the thought behind it. And this year, we're not going so far as trying to advocate for the actual change in the schools, but we have a petition up, and we're asking people and organizations to sign on in support of this. So we're going to create awareness. Then next year, we're going to actually take some actual steps to see the changes on the state level.
So I won't dare to make any sort of presumptions about your age or what decade you were born in, but is it safe to say that you had food education when you were growing up and in school?
Well, thank you for not asking my age. I appreciate that. yes, I did have food education in school, and it's funny you said that because I recently wrote an article in the Huffington Post about my experience with what was called home ec.
Right, of course.
Back in the dark ages. And I loved home ec.
You did?
Home ec made me a person. I actually remember it made me a person who loved to cook and who really got into food and ingredients. I don't know if I had an amazing home ec teacher. I can't even remember her name at this point. But it was really important to me, and it started me on a lifetime of actually cooking. And I remember the boys got, you know, shuffled off to shop class where, you know, they were, you know, hammering nails into their thighs and, you know, blood was squirting and all these, you know, masculine things that they were supposed
right.
to be enjoying. But I also remember that they were really jealous because they would have to walk by the kitchens, these big fancy kitchens they had in our school back in the day, you know, after they were done with shop class. And I felt sorry for them because they smelled these incredible aromas that were coming out that we were really, you know, we were really making. And then, of course, we were getting to eat them. So I hope both boys and girls soon enough have the opportunity to learn to cook, you know, in schools. I think it's an important life skill. And, you know, a lot of the other food education can be blended into other classes like math and social studies and just something that will really serve them well for a lifetime.
Now, is the biggest barrier to it actually being implemented the funding, the fact that we just don't have, our schools don't have the money for it, or is there some, you know, now that we've become largely a nation that cooks less and less and relies on sort of fast food and other people to feed us more and more, is there a stigma against cooking as something that's important to have in our schools, or have we just gotten to the point where we no longer think that it's a priority, or is it purely a matter that we just need to find the money for it?
Well, I can guess on that. I think it's budgetary, mm-hmm. definitely. And I think, you know, I read a lot about, you know, all the schools across the nation are implementing the Common Core, and, you know, which is some kind of new system and trying to get back to basics. It seems like our schools are, you know, always implementing something that's putting a lot of stress on the teachers. And I think, you know, things like, you know, cooking and food skills and shopping skills that used to really be considered important fell by the wayside as school, you know, became, you know, as the school day became more crammed with more and more things that teachers had to teach. So I suspect that, you know, there's been some pushback that there's not enough room for this kind of instruction and budgetary considerations as well.
So, you know, when you're working on a campaign like this from the grassroots level, and it's not yet in the stage where you're going to try to really implement it, but you're trying to raise awareness for it and get people to sign on to petition. So I'm wondering if we could talk a little bit about sort of the relationship between that kind of grassroots activism and then actually enacting policy. You know, in your experience, how do movements like Food Day or the ideas like you know, food education that emerge from them make their way from ideas, you know, actually into legislative offices and eventually get turned into policies? Obviously, that's not a simple question, but
now, how much time do you have?
Well, before we take a break, we have probably like a minute. So if you want to start and then regroup and we can dive back into it after that, that would be perfect.
Okay, well, just as you pointed out, first the idea, you know, emerges, and you know, there's awareness created, and you get a certain you know, body of people generally who are interested in moving this forward, either at the local, state, or federal level. So that's where we are right now with this bringing, you know, food education, cooking back into our schools,
mm-hmm.
and then you really need to get political at that point, and you need to figure out, well, how do we get this back in school? You know, find the body or the person or the people, the decision makers who we have to reach, and we have to figure out, you know, is it simply a matter of talking to them? Is this a matter of changing a regulation? Is it a matter of passing legislation? So you kind of have to do your homework about how to make the change. And, you know, that's really what you have to do before you actually go into a full campaign to get the change to occur.
Okay. Hold that thought. We're going to stop right there. We need to take a quick break, but when we come back, we're going to talk all about what happens once you do your homework and how you get it done. Stay tuned.
You're listening to Spreadin' Honey by the California Honey Drops on the HeritageRadioNetwork.org. Stay tuned for more from Good Food.
You better do what you want when you get up in the morning, 'cause it won't be long before you're dead and gone.
Yeah,
no, there ain't no telling. Yeah, we all just bet. Just a plan of hand till the last stand. So tell your mama you've been spreading honey, won't you? Tell your brother you've been spreading honey, won't you? Tell your sister you've been spreading honey, won't they? Come along and spread some honey too.
Brooklyn Slate Company is a collaborative effort from Brooklyn graphic designer Sean Tice and Parsons graduate student Christy Hedeka. After visiting Christie's family slate quarry in upstate New York in the spring of 2009, the two grabbed a few pieces for use as all-purpose boards back home in Brooklyn. They found a number of purposes for the slate and began gifting pieces to friends. The response was so overwhelmingly positive that the two struck out to produce a line of slate products. They now make regular trips to the family quarry in upstate New York to hand-pick their favorite pieces of black and red slate. Some of the slate is sourced from the quarry graveyard, a collection of odd-shaped pieces that were ultimately destined to be ground for use as road cover or baseball diamonds. They then transport the pieces to their studio in Red Hook, Brooklyn, where they do additional cutting and clean the stone to be food slate. Every single piece of packaging that comes with their products, from the envelope to the burlap bag, can be repurposed for other uses. The end result is a product completely unique in cut, shape, color, and overall presentation. For more information and to order, visit brooklynslate.com.
We are back. You're listening to Good Food on the Heritage Radio Network, and we have been talking with Nancy Hunergarth. Okay, Nancy, I hope I didn't destroy all of your momentum, but before I abruptly veered off into a break, we were talking about sort of the process of turning a grassroots campaign into actual policy and legislation. So you had been saying that you need to identify sort of the political backers who are going to champion the work that you're doing. You said you find them and you go into their office, and then what tends to happen once you identify somebody who you think is going to be on your side? What is sort of the nitty-gritty process of getting the idea onto paper and into law?
Well, normally, once you've identified the policymaker that you or policymakers that you need to convince, it's great to go in with a coalition. And I always recommend to folks who are trying to get any legislation passed, you know, try to find out, you know, who's going to support this and bring them together. So you're all not coming at the same issue as one, but you're coming in as a powerful group. And once you've built your coalition, and your coalition usually is made up of organizations, you know, that do lobbying or do advocacy work. For example, I often have worked with organizations like the American Cancer Society, the American Diabetes Association, the American Heart Association, the American Academy of Pediatrics.
Yeah.
You know, those groups do a lot of work in getting legislation passed, particularly on health issues. So you build your coalition. And you often go in with model legislation. Either you write it, or sometimes legislation has been implemented in another locale or state, and you could use that as your template, but you take that in, you find a champion in the legislative process who will help you introduce this to the legislative body. You write your piece of legislation and you get it introduced. And then the even harder work begins.
Okay. I imagine we'll get to that, but just so I stop encouraging you to talk, in the abstract, let me ask you specifically. I think you've been right in the thick of the debate surrounding policies like, certainly school nutrition standards, but calorie labeling, and even Bloomberg's proposal to limit large sugary drinks. Are there? And you have any concrete examples from those actual campaigns of what it was like, what the particular challenges were, how you succeeded or didn't in certain cases?
Sure. Well, probably the easiest example was calorie labeling.
Mm-hmm.
Our organization, the New York State Healthy Eating and Physical Activity Alliance, with the ridiculously long name, we actually go by NYSHEPA. That's our acronym.
Also a long acronym.
Yes. And I have a long last name, so together it makes people's heads spin. We went county by county trying to get menu labeling passed in New York State. And our goal was to get it passed in so many counties that we'd have to have a state law passed as well. There would be this tremendous momentum. So a calorie labeling law had originally been passed in New York City. I'm sure you'll remember that.
Sure.
That was the first in the nation. And we took that law, and we found sympathetic legislators in about six or seven different counties around New York
mm-hmm.
State, went to them, showed them the law, asked them if they would be willing to introduce it. They were. And then we did some planning, tried to find in each locale, in each county, we build a little coalition in each place that would help us support this law, go to legislative meetings, speak in favor of it, get their constituents to write to legislators in support of the law. So we did the exact same thing in each county, sort of on a smaller scale than you would do in some grand federal piece of legislation.
Yeah.
But it's the same process every time.
And how long did that take you guys?
It was different in every single county. Some counties we were able to get a law, find a champion, build some support, get a law introduced, and get it passed within 6 months.
Wow.
That's really fast. It usually takes much longer. I would say most of them it took about probably a year to a year and a half.
Wow.
And sometimes when you go in with legislation, and I learned this as a new advocate, thinking, boy, you put that piece of, you get that piece of legislation in, and you're good to go. That'll be passed, right away.
Yeah.
You can put it in, and it sort of dies or doesn't go anywhere in committee, whether it's at the state or the local level. Then it gets submitted again, introduced again the next year. There's more interest, but it still doesn't pass. And then year three is the charm. And, suddenly there's the proper support in the legislature, and it gets passed. So you have to go in really understanding that legislation can take a heck of a long time, and you have to be patient.
So that's a decent segue into what I wanted to talk about with you next, which is sort of somebody who is not in the business of making legislation per se, but who is intimately involved in sort of our nation's food system. And that's Michelle Obama, who's someone that you have written about quite a bit, I think. So I'm wondering, as someone, you who are entrenched in this, the real nitty-gritty of pushing our food system forward and into the direction we need it to go, I'm wondering how you relate to the kind of work that the First Lady is doing sort of from the top and continues to do. What does it do for the causes that you're promoting? How does it help? How does it hurt in ways?
Well, that's a really good question. I think Michelle Obama has raised the level of awareness and the level of dialogue about our food system and nutrition and health in this country to levels that I would have never imagined.
Yeah.
I mean, without her involvement and her interest in nutrition and food, you and I probably wouldn't even be talking right now.
Good,
I mean,
good
that's
point.
That's how much impact I think she's had in the last, you know, 4.5 years. However, there's also a little bit of a downside because she really isn't a policymaker. And one of the things that is really important is when you have somebody, you know, raise the level of awareness so high, you want to see sustainable change come out of it. And she's been doing some wonderful things with voluntary agreements and public-private partnerships. But I'm a little bit worried that, you know, once the Obamas pack up their suitcases at the end of his term and, you know, ride off into the sunset, I'm really worried that these initiatives will sort of fizzle out. So that's what concerns me. And I think sometimes these initiatives take the place of real policy change. And something that industry is very deft at saying, well, we don't need policy because look what we're doing.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not sustainable. And as soon as the first lady's gone and the next first lady comes in and her interest has nothing to do with nutrition, I think a lot of these things will fall by the wayside.
So considering that she's not in a position herself to make policy, she certainly is in a position to influence it. But, you know, I guess the expectation is that she isn't necessarily going to promote wholeheartedly interests that might go against what her husband is interested in. So is there a way to pick up, before they pack up and leave, is there a way for other parties to pick up on the momentum that she's created and sort of make the push that perhaps she can't or that she's not in a comfortable position to?
Well, I think a lot of us are trying to do that.
Yeah.
She's focused a lot on food deserts. She's focused on healthy school food. And there, quite frankly, she had a tremendous impact on getting that policy passed, the policy that got competitive school food rules and standards passed, the ones that are going to be implemented soon in our schools. And without her, I don't think that bill would have ever been passed.
Yeah.
So, you know, she's not out in the open, and she's not voting, and she's not a politician.
Sure.
But I think behind the scenes, she was instrumental in making sure that bill got passed. So I think she could do a little bit more of that with some other things. For example, food marketing to kids has been a very hot topic.
Right.
And a couple of years ago, there was a voluntary agreement that some folks in Washington were trying to put together to get food marketing, to get some kind of agreement from industry that they would follow these voluntary standards for marketing foods to kids.
Right.
And it sounded very simple, but the industry pushed back and didn't even want to create voluntary standards, and everyone was waiting for the first lady to say something or work behind the scenes, but she didn't. So that was a little bit disappointing. But all of us keep, you know, moving ahead. Whatever she talks about, and wherever she gets Americans' interest going, you know, we try to take advantage and see if we can turn it into policy.
So we have just a few minutes left, so I want to ask you at least this question, if it's going to be the last one. You know, considering we've been talking about the process of creating progressive food policies and sort of slowly changing our food system, and that Food Day, the nationwide celebration of a just and equitable and fair food system is shortly coming up. Is there anything in particular to be said about the state of the American food movement, whatever that phrase means to you? From someone who is on the ground working on these issues every day, are you able to characterize what that movement is looking like right now, or at least what it looks like to you?
Sure. I mean, there's good things and bad things.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think we've made a lot of progress. I started working in this area in school food in my kids' schools back in 2001, and I've seen tremendous amount of change and understanding and real interest in food issues since then. However, I do see a lot of confusion,
uh-huh.
and I see a lot of groups that sometimes seem to be working at cross purposes.
Yeah.
And I think there needs to be far more unity in the food movement. You know, it's sort of splintered, and folks have, you know, sometimes I think folks are off in different camps, whether it's vegan or they're talking about GMOs or they're talking about school food, and really, we're really all talking about the same thing. And, you know, I think we have to look at this more as a whole package than sometimes each of these individual issues. And one other thing I think is really important is I think the funders who are funding a lot of these organizations and projects that have to do with improving our food system and the nutrition of our population, I think they really need to get together and use their money a little bit more wisely. If you look around the nation, there's so many similar projects going on in so many different cities and towns, and there's nothing wrong with these projects, but before we have evidence that certain initiatives or certain projects work, we're spending money in different towns having them tested. So there
right.
needs to be a lot more unity there.
So is it less a matter of consolidating the issues and focusing in on sort of one or two specific issues to work towards, and more a matter of consolidating the money so that whatever people are working towards has a lot more power behind it?
Well, I wouldn't tell people to not work on their pet issues,
mm-hmm.
but when you're so splintered, I think it's confusing. It's confusing for legislators and policymakers, and it's confusing for the public. So, you know, I think, and all the issues are important, but sometimes you have to prioritize, you know, what the public is ready for and where we should put most of our money and where we should focus for, you know, the short term, and then, you know, create a longer term plan. But right now there's no real coordination, it seems, among many groups. There's some groups that are reaching out and some groups that work together, but I think it could be done a lot better.
Okay, I will make this the absolute last question. If there is one issue in your mind that the public is ready for now, that if you were the decision maker and you could pool all of our money towards that issue, what would it be?
I think it's time to limit junk food marketing to kids.
Yeah.
I think, you know, parents don't want it. They're sick of being undermined by industry. And I just think our legislators have to, you know, I hate to say it, but they have to get a spine and realize that they're representing, you know, the parents and the kids of their areas and not the corporations. And you know, our kids are so precious, and if we can't even protect them from junk food advertising and marketing, which really does, influence the way they eat, then as a society, we've got some issues.
Okay, that's where we're going to end today. We're out of time. I want to thank our guest, Nancy Hunergarth, so much for chatting with us today. Nancy, it's really been a pleasure. Thank you. You have been listening to the Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Daniel Meyer, and I will talk to you again in a few weeks on the next episode of Good Food.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.